glimpsing?
Philomène heard the same strange blend of dread and excitement that always preceded these particular conversations, a drooping and quickening, one on top of the other. In their 8 years together, she had created 5 false glimpsings for Narcisse, including this last. She allowed a moment to pass, and then another.
You can go out and find wives to marry, but I'm the only one who can give you babies.
Narcisse blinked away a bewildered look, then grabbed Philomène roughly by the arm.
Why do you say that?
A small damp piece of brown tobacco clung to the corner of his mouth. Philomène shifted the weight out of her shoulders and farther down into her back, steadying her hand to continue her embroidery. She forced herself to calm, taking her time, speech measured and deliberate.
I see you, an old man, visiting graves of 2 women you married. When you are through, you come back to me. There are many children surrounding you, from big to little, a mix of boys and girls. Our children. They have been brought up quality, never hungry, and they wear new clothes and soft leather shoes fit to their feet. We live in a house big enough to hold all the children, not this cabin. They call you Papa.
Philomène paused, trying to read his mood.
What else?
Narcisse stared sharply at Philomène, as if by so doing he could decipher some word or gesture she had purposely left unspoken. His intensity threatened to unnerve her.
I can only tell you what the glimpsing shows, Philomène said.
Narcisse leaned back again in his chair, as if dismissing her.
I come and go as I please, he said.
You try to skip from this too lightly, Monsieur Narcisse.
It was Philomène now who brought her face closer to his, but she lowered her voice to barely a whisper. She wanted him to have to strain to hear.
First one wife could not give you a child, and then another with the same result. Even your rotting with trash from the hills came to nothing. Forget about a white child. I am the only one who can ever give you offspring. But you must take care. Treat them well.
Philomène put aside her sewing, stood, and took up the lamp to go into the cabin.
Mark my words, Narcisse Frédieu. For you, there is only one way to have children, and that is through me.
In 1872, just months after baby Nick was born, Emily stood before Philomène and Narcisse in the common room of Philomène's cabin. The old green sofa Narcisse had brought from one of his other houses sagged in the middle under his weight, the cushions almost flattened by his bulk, but he sat with great authority, a pose he didn't take often with his daughter. Philomène rocked the baby in the moonlight chair. Emily waited dutifully for Narcisse to let her know why he had called her. At 11, she was soft-spoken but not quiet. Philomène could imagine that her daughter thought she had been summoned to entertain, for which she needed little encouragement. Narcisse loved to watch Emily dance or listen to her sing. Her girlish voice was high and sweet, with a slight unexpected trill she added to the words, and she sang constantly to her brother Eugène, who followed her everywhere. She sang to the chickens as she scattered their feed, she sang to the baby, and she sang for her father whenever he visited. Amusing people was natural to her. A responsible girl, especially with Eugène and baby Nick, Emily went a step beyond, making everything she touched special. She was partial to colors, brought fresh, vibrant wildflowers into the house in spring and summer, and placed green potted plants in the corners in winter. She convinced her Uncle Jérôme to make her a small table and shelf, but insisted that the carved shapes on them be a design of her own making. Emily could always talk Philomène into another new scarf or lace collar or special embroidery to freshen up an old garment. But for all the style and charm that drew people to her daughter, Philomène was most proud that Emily could read. For a time she had studied under a tutor, the old schoolteacher Valérie Oubre, widowed since the death of his wife, Aureline. Philomène thought it fitting that their old master be the one to give Emily advantage. Monsieur Oubre was now frail and in ill health, but he had always been a friend to the family. He had taken Emily as far as she needed to go in French, but Philomène and Narcisse had been discussing for some time how English had begun to intrude on their world.
"Emily," Narcisse announced, "we are sending you to New Orleans. You'll learn to read and write in English and make your first communion there."
Narcisse seemed pleased with the proclamation, but Emily grew flush. She always blushed easily.
"Papa, I don't want to leave Ken River."
"This is for your future, Emily, my dear," Philomène said. "An opportunity not many receive."
Philomène had never been apart from any of her children. Already she missed Emily, but the promise of her daughter continuing her studies was worth almost anything. Philomène planned for Emily to be in a position to teach her brothers when the time came. No one would ever be able to set aside the learning once taught. The color rose higher on Emily's cheeks, the youthful bloom highlighted in her distress.
"Please don't send me away," she said in a small voice.
"You must do as I say, Emily," Narcisse said.
"I'm scared, Papa," Emily said, her eyes filling with tears. "I'll be so lonely."
"There will be other girls, quality girls," Narcisse said. "You deserve better than you can get here. 1 year, and then you'll be back."
Philomène could see the struggle in Narcisse, even though he sounded decisive and unwavering. He had never been a match for Emily's tears.
"I'll take you down on the steamboat myself to New Orleans, and visit often. I've written to a friend who will look after you there. The year will be up before you know it."
A fine sheen of sweat had broken out across Narcisse's forehead.
"Now go help your mother get you ready. We leave at the end of the week."
Chapter 28. Narcisse paid extra for the hired carriage and coachman to wait for him outside the convent gate. It took better than an hour and a quarter to arrange the unloading of Emily's trunk and to enroll her with the nuns. Only then could he take the next step of his journey. The steamboat trip had been fatiguing, from Cane River to the New Orleans dock, but father and daughter were more emotionally spent than physically tired. Narcisse made the trip once or twice a year, but he had never had to release his only daughter into the hands of strangers.
"I'll be back to visit tomorrow," he told Emily.
There had already been tears the week before leaving, and more tears on the boat. Narcisse felt that if he didn't leave immediately, he was likely to shed a few himself. Narcisse usually stayed at the St. Charles Hotel, but Joseph Bille, a distant connection from his mother's side of the family, had insisted in their correspondence that Narcisse accept his hospitality. He set out for the French Quarter without quite knowing where he was going. The coachman had little trouble finding the house on a narrow side street away from the water. It was a modest-looking building set far back behind a stunted 4-foot-high iron fence, but there was a handsome grillwork around each of the second-story balconies. A pleasant woman introducing herself as Joseph Beale's sister answered the front door and took him out to a lovely interior courtyard, while the coachman unloaded his valises and brought them in. There he met Joseph Beale face to face for the first time. Joseph had a wiry French look to him, but cheerful, and was at least 15 years his junior.
"Welcome to my home."
Joseph embraced Narcisse as if they had known each other a lifetime.
"I take it you have already settled your daughter into the convent? Once we establish you upstairs, you can decide how best to shake off the dust. Certainly the completion of such a difficult task begins with brandy."
Narcisse had looked forward to an early night and a firm bed, but he got his second wind. On that first evening, they talked and played cards after supper, Joseph, several cousins, and other guests who stopped by. Joseph entertained them all with stories, then brought out a handsome mandolin, a magnificent instrument with an all-French polished orange front, ebony fingerboard, and rosewood and mahogany ribs. He accompanied himself as he sang, and had a surprisingly rich, deep voice for such a thin man. Narcisse liked Joseph immediately. He laughed at Joseph's unflattering stories of his dealings with Americans and his more forgiving tales of dealing with the French at heart, and Narcisse recited his own reports of the planter's life along the Cane and Red Rivers. Both men embellished for effect. Fatigue finally forced Narcisse to excuse himself. He retired to the guest room, but before drifting off to sleep, he itemized those things he needed to accomplish in New Orleans on his trip. He had his cotton to sell, his promise to Emily that he would visit her every day until he went back home, and 2 weeks to amuse himself while waiting for the return boat back to Cane River. The next day proved to be overcast and drizzly, and after attending early morning mass, Narcisse took Joseph with him when he visited Emily at the convent. Narcisse was taken aback when he saw her in her new austere setting. She seemed lost inside a coarse gray dress that swallowed her. Not even the drabness of her new uniform in the convent, however, so unlike the way Philomène would have dressed the girl, could rob Emily of her prettiness. Again Emily looked close to tears. The three met in the convent parlor, then went outside in the courtyard to find a seat on a wood bench in the shade of a large magnolia tree, under the watchful eyes of the patrolling nuns. "So you are Mademoiselle Emilie," Joseph said before he sat. "Such a small thing." He leaned down to kiss Emily lightly on both cheeks.
"I am Joseph Bill, and once your father returns home, child, it will be up to me to bring you some fun from outside these convent walls to keep you from melancholy."
He had a mischievous glint in his eye, as if he and Emily were planning an exotic journey together, but Emily looked more dejected than ever.
"I see I haven't said the right thing."
Joseph made his face serious.
"We must work very hard at being friends, you and I. Your father will have my head if I don't honor my promise to cheer you up while you are in New Orleans. You don't want to see me lose my head?"
Emily tried to smile.
"Can you guess where I am from?"
Emily looked at her father's friend shyly.
"France, but you don't sound like any of the Frenchmen I've heard."
"What a good ear you have." "I am here only 2 years from France. But I am told that since I grew up so close to the border with Spain, my French is not so pure. But then, neither is the Creole French most speak here."
"I like the way you sound."
Narcisse watched the two of them, relieved to see a little of Emilie's spirit returning, grateful she was warming up to Joseph.
"Already I can see that we must call you by a very special nickname. And it has just come to me what the name should be."
"A name for me?"
Emily was clearly drawn in, had seemed to forget for a moment how miserable she was.
"You are so dainty. I must call you Mademoiselle Petit."
This time Emily managed a full smile. Joseph had won her over. Over the next 2 weeks, Narcisse and Joseph discovered how alike they were in their love of fun, drink, and parties. An ambitious man, Joseph seemed full to overflowing with ideas and short-term schemes. Narcisse envied Joseph his independence and wandering, his nose for risk and opportunity, and the intensity and stamina of youth, and Joseph was clearly intrigued by Narcisse's descriptions of life in the countryside of central Louisiana. They both visited Emily for the permitted hour each remaining day Narcisse stayed in New Orleans. Narcisse couldn't help but swell at the beauty Emily radiated. While he was a substantial man, so fond of food and drink that he found it increasingly difficult to button his vests, everything about Emily was small and delicate, from her tiny feet to her slim waist, but she was neither frail nor fragile. At the end of 2 weeks, Narcisse had to admit that the results of his trip to New Orleans were mixed. Although he had safely established Emily at the convent, his business dealings had been far less satisfactory. The most he'd been able to arrange was just over 8 cents a pound for his meager cotton crop. When he boarded the steamship Danube for the trip back to Cane River, he left New Orleans leaden with the absence of his daughter, already missing his new friend, and pessimistic about the dismal financial prospects of yet another planting season. Narcisse and Joseph began to exchange visits back and forth throughout the year Emily stayed in New Orleans. In April, Joseph came for the first time to Cane River to visit, and Narcisse introduced him into both his white and his colored life. They went together to soirees, they joined several hunting parties, and they fished. Narcisse was full of pride at being able to show off the splendor of the Cane River countryside. At Philomène's, Joseph dined on crawfish stew, pig's knuckles, and black-bottom pie, and he met Eugène and Nick, Emily's younger brothers. Joseph became a favored guest in Narcisse's circle, carrying his mandolin with him everywhere and winning over audiences with his music. But on each of Narcisse's return visits down the Mississippi River to New Orleans, he confronted the march of time. Emily was fast slipping past girlhood, more noticeable because he saw her with a fresh eye every few months. It started out as a small idea, on the porch of Philomène's cabin one evening as they talked of how much they missed Emily. But by the next day, Narcisse had become determined to capture his daughter's image before she crossed over into womanhood. At his request, Joseph located a painter in New Orleans who did inexpensive oil portraits, and he secured permission from the sisters for Emily to leave the convent for the 3 required sittings at the artist's studio. Emily wore her intended communion dress. Joseph's sister had sent a sketch of the current style to Cane River, along with yards of fluffy white organdy material, and Philomène spent 2 weeks sewing to match the picture. The dress was simple, emphasizing the quality of the material. Intricate lace decorated the scooped neck, matched by the same lace around the tips of the sleeves, and the bodice was unadorned. It was designed to fall from the cinched waist to the middle of Emily's calf. The artist managed to capture Emily's bearing on his canvas. She appeared both serene and lively, from her long exposed neck to her tiny boot-clad feet. Her left hand skimmed the bowed crown of a small straight-backed chair, and her right was held palm inward, primly, in front of her waist. Sandy light hair fell behind her ears and down her back in ringlets, and as Narcisse had requested, she wore her new cone-shaped hat plumed with an ostrich feather. Narcisse was pleased with the portrait, as was Emily. He personally oversaw the packing for shipment and took the painting back with him to Cane River. Keeping the portrait near softened the ache of not having his daughter by his side. After Emily's year of study at the convent ended and she took her first communion, Narcisse went down to New Orleans to collect her and bring her home. Another bad crop year had forced him to concede that his holdings were not going well. Something had to be done soon, something bold. Both the war between the states and Reconstruction had taken their toll, and there appeared to be no way to restore his personal fortunes of earlier, better times. He had already sold some of his land to keep things going, but the buyers had the advantage, and he didn't have much more land to sell. The condition of his home place and even his farm animals was deteriorating alarmingly. An opportunity finally presented itself that could turn his fortune in a positive direction, although Narcisse had to admit he had neither the financial wherewithal nor the appetite for personal labor required to make his scheme work. He needed a partner. There was land to be gotten cheaply on the other side of Red River in Grant Parish, not far from his home place as the crow flew. It was thick with virgin pine trees that could be used for timber and turpentine, and after it was cleared for farming. But the real advantage was its location. The land bordered huge expanses of protected government property, and for a man willing to take the risk, substantial money could be made. While the owner of the property cleared and cultivated the rightfully purchased land, he could poach the inexhaustible trees on the adjacent government land at the same time, sending them upriver to hidden sawmills. Narcisse knew he could easily find the labor. Plenty of freedmen scratching out a living would be happy for the work and could be trusted not to share the details of their illegal doings. Philomène's brother Jérôme had worked for him before on a smaller scale, for 6 cents an hour, and there were others who would do the same. The profit potential was enormous. Joseph Biel would fit the bill perfectly. Joseph was anxious to put down roots in a French-speaking community, ambitious enough to bend as necessary, smart enough to keep the undertaking going, and willing to work hard to make the project successful. And he came with money in his pocket to fund the venture up front. And he knew how to have a good time in the bargain. Narcisse sent a letter off to New Orleans, expecting an answer by return post.
Quenriville, December 22, 1874. Dear Monsieur Joseph, I hope this letter finds you well and preparing for the joy of your holidays. We expect to spend a traditional Christmas and New Year's here, and would welcome a visit from you if you are not otherwise engaged. Your mandolin would certainly be appreciated for the festivities, as would, of course, your splendid company. There is another motive for this letter and invitation. We have talked in the past about your growing fondness for this beautiful country, away from the turmoil of New Orleans. I have an excellent proposal to discuss with you that could be of benefit to both of us. I dare not entrust it to a letter. This demands a frank discussion between two friends, and I am sure a man of your talents and ambitions will grasp the unlimited opportunity this partnership could bring. We need to act quickly before others understand the possibilities. This could be the beginning of a solid partnership in addition to our friendship. Say hello to your sister and your cousins for me. Looking forward to hearing from you soon. Your committed friend, Narcisse Fredieu.
Christmas and New Year's came and went with no word, as Narcisse's creditors became increasingly impatient. Finally, near the end of January, a posting came, not from New Orleans, but from Pointe-Coupée. Narcisse recognized Joseph's neat hand on the envelope.
Pointe-Coupée, January 27, 1875. Dear Monsieur Narcisse, I make haste to answer your letter, dated December 22nd, from last month. You will excuse me for not having written back sooner. I was gone into the countryside here with friends who had come to town, and they insisted very strongly that I come with them. I have therefore been working until now, and every Saturday we played music at local dances. I am quite happy with the friends here. My uncle had your letter sent to me by an opportunity the other day. But since you are telling me you have an excellent place for me, and that I should come, I gladly accept in order to be closer to you. As I have noted in letters I have written to you, I appreciate your company. Dear friend Narcisse, you will see the proof of it. I will take the steamboat Bart Abel on its way north from New Orleans to come next Saturday to give you a friendly handshake, to you and also to Madame Philomène and to Mademoiselle Petit and to the little boys and to all the friends. Nothing more for the present. While waiting to see you soon, I am, as I take leave of you now, your fully devoted friend for life, Joseph Biel.
In less than 2 months, Joseph moved part-time to Red River and began to demonstrate that he had a gift of sweeping land and money to him, like a broom.
Chapter 29.
I wonder what Monsieur Joseph will do with the land he bought over in Grand Parish, Emily began at dinner one rainy afternoon in June.
There was hardly space enough at the table in the common room to move without having to slide a chair forward or bump elbows with someone, but they gathered here every Sunday for family dinner. There seemed to be more family to squeeze into the cramped cabin every month.
Unless he was the one to put the food on this table, we are not talking about Joseph Biel again today,
Philomène said. A man after just the one thing, Suzette mumbled and quickly lowered her eyes. Emily felt herself blush furiously, but it was to Nicolas that her grandmother Suzette sent an apologetic look when she lifted her head again. Since she had married and moved in with Nicolas Moulin, Suzette had become looser in her speech when the pair came to Sunday dinner. Nicolas gave Suzette an indulgent return look. An easygoing husband, he fit in well, and it had sealed the collective family opinion unanimously in his favor when he'd crafted each of them a pair of custom shoes from his cobbler's bench. The Frenchman is older than I am, Philomène said. I have no intention of allowing any more child mothers in this family. Let the girl be, Elizabeth brokered, but then turned to Emily. You might want to talk about something else until you have some fresh news. It has been almost 2 months since any of us even saw the man. Emily had been overjoyed to come back home to Cane River. She hadn't really seen too much of the city of New Orleans, tucked away as she had been most of the time behind convent walls, and what she had seen made her miss her home even more. Too many harsh sounds, vendors yelling along the street, people close together and in a hurry, not enough soil where things could grow. The other girls were nice enough, but it was temporary, and she had missed her own people more than she'd thought possible, even her younger brothers. But being delivered back safely into the arms of family meant she saw less of Joseph, and she could hardly bear it. Emily had been intrigued with Joseph Beale from the moment he'd appeared alongside her father in the New Orleans convent parlor. He carried more of France than Louisiana in speech, outlook, and bearing, clearly a newcomer to a foreign land. His visits to the convent helped ease that lonely year in New Orleans, even though she knew his attentions were at her father's request, merely looking after a friend's daughter. He had a side-by-side shyness and self-confidence in his manner, and even though he was a white man, he conducted himself toward her with unaffected acceptance. Emily found it dizzying. At the New Orleans convent, Joseph had been polite yet playful, treating her in the affectionate but offhand way an adult treats a child. The first time he called her Mademoiselle Petit, his eyes danced. From his eyes to her heart. By the time she left the convent a year later, each breath she drew, every thought she held, took Joseph Beale into consideration. She was almost 14, a woman now. Joseph Beale just didn't realize it yet. Emily's high spirits and optimism could turn in a moment to an irritable restlessness, and she seemed powerless to stop it. She lashed out at her younger brothers then, the way she would not dare with the old women. Emily could see how baffled her brothers were, no longer as eager to be around the moody, sullen girl. She was sulky when Joseph was gone away from Cane River, and snappish when he returned but didn't come to visit. Sometimes she spilled over, stalking off, furious at how tightly everyone hung on to her. She got into the habit of taking long walks by herself, staying away for an hour or more with no explanation, and because she came back in a quieter mood, the household tolerated her disappearances. Emily was the first generation they could afford to pamper. Most times Joseph came around to pay his respects to Philomène's family, he did so with Narcisse. Whenever he came alone, Emily was assigned chaperones. As if she could get Joseph to think of her in that way, Emily thought. She glowed in his presence and wasn't coy about showing her delight with his company. She wore only her best dresses, pinched her cheeks to redden them, and spent hours practicing in the mirror, piling sandy brown hair on top of her head in styles that made her look older. But someone, siblings, uncles, aunts, mother, grandmother, or great-grandmother, always had a vigilant eye out. If Emily retrieved her long-billed bonnet so she and Joseph could take a walk, Philomène or Elizabeth would call, "Eugène, Nick, go with them." Henry, the latest baby brother, was too small, or he would have been assigned to watch, too. It seemed that everyone except Joseph thought she was in danger of his advances. On Emily's 16th birthday, the old women invited Joseph and Narcisse to a celebration in her honor. Joseph had just returned from New Orleans and in a particularly good mood. He brought all of them gifts, not just Emily. He gave Elizabeth a black and red fan that opened and closed with an impressive snap. For Suzette, he brought a tatted lace handkerchief, so snowy white and fine that she kept it folded in her drawer, taking it out only to run her fingers gently over the fabric or stare at it in wonder. He presented 4 tins of high-quality snuff to Philomène. The boys got spurs, a slingshot, and a harmonica, according to age. Joseph saved Emilie's present for last, pulling a flat-wrapped package out of his storage sack. He handed it to her without any of his usual joking. He simply said, "For you, mademoiselle." Emilie felt him watching her, as did everyone else in the room. She happily unfolded the brown paper and lifted the top from the slim box. Inside was a pair of fine black lace gloves, not the usual peppermint candy he always brought. She knew it was a signal that she had grown up in his eyes at last. From that day forward, Joseph's visits to Philomène's house took on a different tone, and he came more often alone. Joseph seemed hard-pressed to pull his eyes away from Emily's dimples or the fluttering of her hands. In those early days of their start-and-stop courtship, Joseph spent half his time in New Orleans and half at the store he had opened in Grant Parish. Whenever he returned, he came calling to Philomène's cabin, bringing fresh stories of a world beyond Cane River. As far as her mother knew, Emily and Joseph were never alone. Philomène doubled her chaperone efforts when Joseph officially came calling, but Emily became especially clever at taking her alone walks out of the sight of nosy younger brothers and prying women. A tangle of sparse woods dotted the path to a small abandoned cotton house, a brisk 20-minute walk from the cabin, and whenever they could arrange it, Emily slipped away to meet Joseph alone there. By then, his pet name for her was Mademoiselle Tite. The talking quickly gave way to touching. Everything about Joseph, his wiry build and careless walk, the sharpness of his nose, the thick flow of his hair, thrilled Emily. But his ears were her weakness. Joseph told her once that he had gotten into fist fights as a boy in France, defending the size and shape of his ears, unwilling to take the teasing. They stood out from his face at an assertive angle, brash and uncompromising in the same way Joseph was. Emily liked to trace the bold sweep of those ears with the tip of her finger, making him laugh, and then he would follow the small arc of hers with his blunt hand, his hazel eyes, and spare lips working together to produce a devilish smile. Bringing that smile into being was Emily's yardstick of her own happiness. His thick mustache was like a waterfall, covering his top lip completely, and the stiff hairs prickled when they kissed. Joseph showed her the special comb he had purchased for his whiskers, an indulgence for such a frugal man. He spent more time combing, cutting, and shaping that mustache than he did the sandy hair he kept trimmed short on the top of his head. The rest of his face he kept clean-shaven. His cheeks were full for such a thin man, and because the underlying bone structure was high, a deep shadow played constantly between his ear and his mouth. An inner amusement crackled in his deep-set eyes, almost overshadowed by thick, wayward eyebrows that would have startled and overwhelmed his face had they not been muted by their sandy brown paleness. Emily's skin was smoother and more fair than Joseph's, because she always took such care to cover herself against the danger of the darkening rays of the sun, and he was an outdoorsman. Her hair was as straight, her nose as thin, her penmanship hand straighter and stronger. Everyone told her she was beautiful, had been telling her that since before she could understand their words. They also told her she was better, meant for better things. But she was colored, and Joseph was white, and to most, Those were the defining facts that mattered. In the Cotton House, there were no such discussions, no such limitations. After the initial upheaval, those ancient women Emily came from took the news of her impending motherhood in stride. Their presence had cocooned her for as long as she could remember, and although their disappointment at the beginning stung, they helped her without blame in every way they knew how through the carrying and delivery. By the time little Angelite arrived, the baby was absorbed seamlessly into the cabin, as if she belonged to all of them. Each of the elders was eager to demonstrate her mother cures. When a wasp stung Angelite, Philomène applied tobacco juice and the swelling went down. When Suzette visited, she would hold the baby and rock for hours, using her finger to rub Angelite's gums, giving the little girl some relief from the violation of her emerging teeth. Once, as Emily helplessly watched Angelite struggle for air, her great-grandmother Elizabeth fried down a piece of mutton, added turpentine and salve to the suet, soaked a piece of flannel in the fat, and put the warm concoction on the baby's chest until her breathing eased. Occasionally, the women disagreed among themselves about the most effective remedy for this cough or that fever, and Emily would just wait for the winning strategy to emerge. As if she had not helped to move four younger brothers from diapers to long pants, or had not taken care of the little sister who struggled to live in that first year of her life before giving up the fight. It was comforting to have so much knowledge at her disposal, always an extra set of hands when needed, especially with Joseph gone so often. Joseph still lived across the river in the back of his store, and Emily's place was on Philomène's farm, even after Angelique was born. She rose before dawn every morning, sometimes leaving the baby with Elizabeth, sometimes carrying Angelique with her for the day, and crossed the river to help Joseph. She felt daring, adventurous, venturing out beyond Cane River and across the Red River into an entirely different parish. Emily carried herself above the side glances and the sly whispers. Insatiable tongues told stories about the Frenchman and the quadroon, endlessly cataloguing what was wrong, what was unnatural about the two of them being together. It wasn't the appearance of the child that sparked such heated interest from the people in the woods and in the town. It was Joseph's dogged insistence on including both Emily and Angelite in his talk, in his thinking, in his plans. Chapter 30. "These children are yours," Philomène said, the flushed skin of her face stretched taut and her eyes narrowed. Narcisse had reached a dangerous age, an age when men's thoughts turned to their own mortality, when they examined all they had managed to build in a lifetime of work and could feel only the urgency of where it would go when they were dead. By law, he needed legitimate children to pass his inheritance to. If his children had been white, he could adopt them. If Philomène had been white, he could have married her. It was an impossible situation for a man obsessed with heirs. Philomène had seen his mind working the problem for some time, even as he supported and defended his colored family. "You may be getting yourself ready to walk on to something new, but that doesn't change you being the father." Philomène and Narcisse sized each other up, like a pair of old fighting cocks preparing to spar one last time. They were especially careful, either capable of drawing first blood, each searching for the best possible opening. Philomène looked with uncompromising eyes at the man grown soft around the middle, deep lines etching his forehead. Getting ready to leave her after 20 years and 7 children, 2 lost in infancy. Philomène had to give him due credit. He still kept himself clean and neat, and his beard was recently trimmed with a precision and patience reserved for the very rich or the very vain. The truth of the matter was that he had really left her the year before. They had just not spoken of it. The power she exercised over him for years had diminished, until what they held between them now was mostly habit and old scars. And their children. As soon as Philomène heard he was to have a child by Clemie Larieux, she knew her time had run out, the spell broken. It hadn't taken long for the news to travel the byways of Cane River that Narcisse had gone back to White. Clemie had been safely delivered of his white child, a girl. By all accounts, Clemie was poor white trash living in the Piney Woods hill country, probably another shadow union for Narcisse. Philomène was sure he would marry again if he proved to himself he could produce a legitimate male heir by a more respectable woman. It always seemed to come to this. No matter what happened early in their lives, whatever choices these Frenchmen made in their youth, in the end, the need for a legitimate heir reasserted itself, all the stronger for being ignored. The need became as singular and focused as their original lust had been. There was no way around it. The best Philomène could hope to do now was protect her children from indifference and desertion. Narcisse squared off.
"I know they're my children," he said. "When have I ever turned my back? You lived a good life for me, too. Both Emilie and Eugène can read. I didn't have to do that. Nick, Henri, and Joseph will get their turn. Not one has ever gone hungry. They hold their heads up, dress better than most. You've lived in the same house for over 10 years. Your only task to raise them. I saw to that." "My only task?"
Philomène's tone was strained, but she kept her voice steady and didn't allow him to bait her. She had to think clearly. There was much more at stake than her pride. Her family depended on her to manage the situation.
"You think I don't know you're ready to go?" she said. "That I don't know about Clemie?" "Mademoiselle Clemenceau to you," Narcisse snapped. "She's a white lady. You show her respect."
He eased back immediately, seeming to think better of attack.
"All these years gone. Years with you saying I could only have children by you. I love each of my children, and I'll do right by them. I need an heir. It's time to take care of my line. Get back to my own kind."
"You will do whatever pleases you," Philomène said. "But you still have these 5 children and a grandchild. They are your line, too. Some of them barely out of short pants, some not walking yet. They have needs."
She paused and her eyes narrowed, judging the timing.
"And another on the way."
Narcisse hit her, a sudden blow to her face with his closed fist. She hadn't seen it coming. It happened so swiftly that Philomène registered the flat, hollow sound before the pain. She stayed where she was, staring at him, not even bringing hand to face to touch her swelling jaw. No more glimpsings could protect her now. They stood facing one another, both breathing hard.
"You say anything now to keep me from going," Narcisse said. "How do I know there really is another child? It won't change my plans."
Philomène stood erect, saying nothing, and a long moment passed. Narcisse broke the silence first, a compromising quality to his softened tone.
"I'll still give you something from time to time."
"Something and time to time are not what I'm looking for," Philomène said. "You have plenty of land, and we deserve some of it to build our own place, and a stake to get us started. A cow, a horse, and some chickens. We can work the place ourselves, while you move on to your legitimate heirs."
She spat out the last as if it were blood collecting in her mouth. In spite of the growing redness, she kept her face steady and unyielding, and she stared directly into Narcisse's eyes. He glared back at her, a look mixed with anger and contempt. This was her last stand with him. They both knew it.
"I'll give you whatever I have a mind to give you, and nothing more," Narcisse said. "You'd better keep a civil tongue. I don't know who you think you are, making demands, hanging on beyond your time. You think you can steal all of these years from me without consequence? Making me believe I could never have white children? And then try to tell me what I have to do for you?
His face had turned a dark, mottled color, and there was an angry twitch to his mouth as he talked.
"You think you are so high and mighty that you can make up anything else and I'll believe what you say? I gave you a decent life, a slave, and I treated you better than you had any right to expect."
Philomène silently stood her ground. She knew this man, and if anything could influence him, it would be the dawning acceptance that there would be another child. The last few months had not all been tight silences, absences, or arguments, especially after the death of their little Josefina.
"I should have known all along that you didn't have the power to see into the future," Narcisse said. "All these years thinking you could find out about Beth through glimpsing, and you're as blind to that as anything else that hasn't happened yet."
"Beth?" Philomène's voice faltered. She had no idea where they were headed as the familiar direction of their confrontation lurched off course. Narcisse never talked about Beth and Thénée, and she never talked about Clément. It was one of their wordless agreements. Her daughters had been dead for almost 20 years. She still sometimes went alone to visit the site where Beth and Thénée had been buried in their single grave. A stunted willow tree grew over the lonely spot on what used to be Ferrier's farm.
"You hold yourself above other people with your glimpsings," Narcisse went on. "You tricked me. But the whole time you had no idea that your daughter was just a few miles away. You're not as clever as you think."
"What are you saying, Narcisse?"
There was no bite left in Philomène's words. No strategy, no calculation, no demand. Narcisse hesitated.
"Beth is alive," he said. "She didn't die in the yellow fever epidemic. Thénée couldn't recover after the fever, but Beth was stronger, and she fought harder."
Philomène backed away from Narcisse, one wobbly step and then two.
"Aureline had just taken sick and couldn't leave her bed. I was the only healthy one, still able to move around on Ferrier's farm by then. A boy came from my plantation, just minutes after I watched Thénée die. I had been gone for 2 days, and they sent him because they were worried. Beth was sick, but still fighting. So I sent her away with the boy to one of my farms downriver. There was a slave woman there, Aunt Sarah, a good nurse. I was so tired already, and I hadn't been able to save Thénée. I thought she could look after the baby better than I could, while I stayed on with you and Aureline. It seemed the best course at the time."
Narcisse spoke in a monotone, as if the too long hoarding of the story had ground down all of the contours.
"After a few days, Aureline was getting better. She only had a mild case, and even you were starting to come around a little. But it was clear you couldn't take care of a baby in your condition. You could barely lift your head. Even after your delirium passed, you were so weak that you didn't have any idea what was going on around you. I just left things the way they were, and said both babies had died. I'm not sure why. Aureline wasn't part of it."
Narcisse found his way to the moonlight chair and slumped into it.
"I thought it was better to wait and see whether Beth recovered before telling you any different. A family down on my place raised her as Elizabeth, without knowing any of this. She didn't move after freedom. She married a boy down there."
Philomène barely breathed. All she could think of was the terrible loneliness she had felt after the yellow fever, when she woke up to find everyone in her world gone. A loneliness so deep that she thought she would die from it. Even the attentions of Narcisse Frédieu seemed preferable to that. Beth alive? She heard a raw, low, guttural sound that seemed to have neither beginning nor end, but when she looked past Narcisse to find the source, she found it came from her. She couldn't stop. Narcisse stared at her uncertainly. He looked as if he were waiting for something more. She had seen the expression before, whenever they talked of the glimpsings. Narcisse seemed almost contrite to Philomène. his face a curious mass of slits and folds and whiskers. He struck her as odd and ridiculous, and she started to laugh, great gulping laughs, so deep that she could hardly catch her breath. The longer she laughed, the more alarmed Narcisse looked, but he kept his distance across the room. At some point, she couldn't remember why she was laughing, and she stopped. Silence hugged each corner of the room, like a shroud.
Philomène, listen to me. I have land near where Beth is living, down at the mouth of Cane River, near the Grand Natchitoches Parish border. I've always intended to deed you that piece of land, and you can raise the children there. Beth will be just a few minutes away. It's not too late to get to know her.
Philomène didn't respond, pacing absently.
Get out of my chair, she said finally. Philomène, let's talk.
She turned her back, unable to look at him.
Get out of my chair,
she said again, to the wall. She heard scraping noises that let her know he was standing. Philomène turned and crossed the room, passed in front of Narcisse, but was careful not to touch him. She curled herself into her chair, pulling her knees into her chest. Narcisse walked out of the room then. Through the open bedroom door, she saw him stop to say something to Emily in the common room. Emily gathered the family to her as Narcisse disappeared, and they gave Philomène worried glances. Philomène rocked, stroking the smooth arms of the moonlight chair under her fingertips, embraced by the chair that had cost Clément his life. She was dimly aware of Emily coaxing her to come to their bed, but Philomène couldn't leave the chair, not until she had a sense of what direction her life should take. At some point she dozed, and when her eyes opened again it was still dark outside. She was covered with a quilt someone must have put over her as she slept. Philomène thought of Emily, the daughter she knew so well, and now Beth, the daughter she had not been allowed to know at all. Half-sisters. Slowly in the night, a plan began to take shape. Philomène beat back the temptation to let herself drift into the comfort of hating Narcisse. It would only get in the way, and she didn't have the time. She had to make sure she settled on the land he promised quickly, and that it was legal. She would move and take her family with her, all of them. By first light, Philomène was ready to go find Beth. Philomène saddled their horse and set off down river with little Joseph, missing close to a day's work around the farm. She got back shortly before nightfall and called everyone into the kitchen, putting Joseph down in the crib. Her children gathered around her, Emily holding Angélique, and Eugène, Nick, and Henry. When Philomène spoke, her voice was level.
You all have an older sister now. Soon we will move near her to a new place. Your sister's name is Beth. She's 19, older than Emily, and already married. Next Sunday she'll join us for dinner. You'll treat her like your own.
She ignored the bald look of surprise from her sons and the darting flash of something she couldn't quite identify that distorted Emily's features for a moment. Reproach? Jealousy? Anger? Philomène's tone precluded questions. Each Sunday was set aside for family on the new place. Short of fever or flood, everyone was expected for Sunday dinner at Philomène's. There was no great distance to travel. By 1880, they all lived on her property. Philomène asked them one by one to live with her.
163 acres, signed over legal, she told them.
I always knew you had it in you, said Elizabeth.
We need more room for all these families and children. If you get the materials, I can build the houses, Jérôme offered.
Yellow John and I would like nothing better than to be a part of your family, said Dora Lise.
Isaac is strong, and we can both help, said Beth, in the quiet, generous way Philomène was coming to understand. Anything to be close to you.
The houses and the land belonged to Philomène, but she took the third position behind Suzette and Elizabeth in Sunday's kitchen. Her grandmother presided over dinner preparations from her chair by the rough-hewn kitchen table, passing judgment on the dishes as they were being prepared. She gave advice on coaxing the lumps out of gravy, whipping the butter and sugar together to get the fluffiness for sweet potato pie, and heating the grease exactly hot enough, the secret to frying the best chicken. No one dared say to Elizabeth that they considered themselves accomplished cooks, taught at her own knee. At 81, Elizabeth conserved her movements, navigating slowly from chair to couch to bed after so many years spent standing. Her eyesight frequently failed her, especially for close work, and at night, no matter how bright Philomène turned the light up for her, Elizabeth had to give up her needlework. Even stitching quilts was more than her stiff fingers could manage. But she continued doing what she could and oversaw everything. She could still pluck a chicken clean by feel, and she gave counsel to her children, her grandchildren, and her great-grandchildren. From her central spot in the kitchen, Elizabeth was as much a part of Sunday dinners as the heaping bowls and platters of food that made their way to the table in the chipped and mismatched containers. Elizabeth always had her big, wide-mouthed tin bowl near, handy for shelling peas or washing greens or 100 other uses, and it was she who officially started Sunday dinner each week while everyone else went to early morning Sunday Mass. Elizabeth celebrated God in her own way. If Elizabeth was the guiding mind in the kitchen, Suzette provided the hands. Philomène had finally gotten her mother to move in with her after the death of Nicolas Moulin in the late spring flood of 1880. Suzette was Madame Moulin, and Philomène hoped she never saw herself through the eyes of some along Cane River, who talked of her as if she had been a second-class keeper for someone else's children, now grown and on their own. Philomène had watched her mother make the long leap from no last name at all to Jackson and then Moulin. Suzette embraced Jackson, as if it could erase the indignities of the past and make her whole. After she and Nicolas married, she had been just as fervent about becoming Suzette Moulin. Nicolas' people still looked down on Suzette. The old deep ruts of class, temporarily dislocated by emancipation, reasserted themselves, but Nicolas had been clear in his choice. A more stable time would have rejected the match outright as crossing too many lines of color and class, but the years after the war were no such time, and the circumstances called for compromise. Philomène was grateful at how peaceful her mother seemed to be now, how sure she had been of Nicolas. They gathered around the Sunday dinner table. Elizabeth, an old woman stooped and marked with life, had an active face, a participating face that made itself felt. She lived with Philomène in the main house, and they all took care of her in tribute to the way she had taken care of each of them, the oldest of the old generation. Next to her at the table were Doralise and Yellow John, beyond the age of parenthood, but content in a quiet and comfortable marriage. Gérard and his wife, Mélantine, lived in one of the outer houses, had 5 children already, and never came empty-handed, bringing a jar of preserves or a 3-layer jelly cake as their offering. And Philomène's own children, ranging in age from 20 to not quite 3. Emily with her own daughter Angélite, and Eugène, Nick, Henry, and Joseph, and Bette. Bette was a miracle, a piece of Clément. Philomène could see him in Bette's face, in the slope of her forehead, the way it swept out and up. Fresh-faced at 22, she was already married to a serious boy named Isaac Purnell. Bette was larger, darker, more accepting, and without Emily's fire or charm, but she also had a quiet gentleness that sought out only the best in everyone and put them at ease. Philomène regretted that Emily and Bette didn't get along better than they did, but she could recognize Emily's resentment at having to give up her cherished spot as the only daughter, her bewilderment at Bette's late-coming challenge. Philomène was just beginning to know the shy young woman who was her other daughter. Bet and Isaac lived with her in the main house. Philomène was glad to sit. She was almost to term carrying her 10th child, including the one buried under the willow on Ferrier's farm, and 2 buried at Marco Cemetery. It wasn't difficult to see herself through her people's eyes, the huge swelling of her belly straining against the material of her dress, again, the tired circles under her eyes, the downward pull that time demanded of most of her body. Her face was even beginning to take on a roundness like Suzette's, a wild departure from the haughty look of the sharp-faced young woman she had been. It felt like a time of triumph. Noisy chatter and full-throated laughter rang out at the big table. At the children's table there was so much youthful energy between her children and their cousins that she had to fix her eye on them to make sure they behaved. Joseph Biel, Emily's Frenchman, had taken it upon himself to entertain, telling noisy stories at the dinner table. This was the serious occasion of his first Sunday dinner at Philomène's, and he was trying hard to be accepted, as if he fully understood the significance of the invitation. The women of the house debated for some time how best to handle the Frenchman, who always went away and always came back to Emily and baby Angélique when he returned. Joseph and Emily were like magnets, a union not of convenience or opportunity, but of the most central necessity, a union that threatened such permanence that the household had to make special arrangements to accommodate it. The familiarity of the scene teased at Philomène's mind as they passed the food around the table, filling up their plates. They were all here together. Elizabeth, Suzette, Doralise, Jérôme, Emily, Bette. Philomène leaned forward to take the large blue-banded bowl of creamed corn from Bette's hands when her fingers seized up with the sudden recognition. The bowl dropped, breaking into several large jagged pieces, and too many smaller shards to count, the yellow juice leaking into the floorboards. As both Bette and Emily jumped to their feet to clean up the mess, Philomène laughed aloud. Everyone around the table stared at her in surprise, but there was too much joy in the moment for her to try to contain her gladness. The final glimpsing had come to pass, the one that had brought hope to Elizabeth, Suzette, and herself when it seemed the world had taken a perverse personal interest in making sure that their family would be torn apart. They were all together again, and there were seeds of new beginnings.
Part 3. Emily. Chapter 31. If Emily hadn't been so nervous about how Joseph would react to this thinly disguised Sunday appraisal, it would have been almost entertaining to watch her women swarm him without ever leaving their seats around the dining room table. They probed him with their veiled eyes and unasked questions, all moving inexorably toward the same challenges. Will you be good for our Emily? When will you get tired enough to pick up and leave? Will you take care of the children? How long? The Sunday dinner was an acknowledgement of the seriousness of their liaison, a public act as momentous as the arrival of Angélique. Today was Joseph's first official family function. The new house near the meeting point of Cane River and Red River seemed to Emily to be shrinking. So many relatives had been taken in. With Joseph's frequent absences, the company was welcome, but the house, although much bigger than their old cabin, was already bursting at the seams, too small for so many generations of women. And it was difficult to watch her mother moon over Bette under the same roof. Emily could see the snaking of each of their thoughts as they inched toward Joseph. Elizabeth had taken to him as soon as she saw how he held Angélique with fondness and protection. Suzette, always a changeling in the presence of white folks, was wary. She fussed and flitted, smiled wide enough to reveal the gap between her front teeth, and pressed food and drink on him, all the while listening over the noisy conversations of Sunday dinner,
for evidence of the timing of Joseph's inevitable departure from her granddaughter. But it was her mother's opinion that worried Emily most. Philomène tolerated Joseph and was civil to a fault, but Emily knew her mother was waiting for Joseph to somehow prove himself further, this Sunday dinner invitation notwithstanding. Emily was proud to bring Joseph into this den of women and young boys, a man of her own who was making something of himself, a man who came willingly into her mother's house and sat to table under the critical eye of three generations of women. They fawned over Emily's chosen, but that didn't mean they were accepting, that they weren't watching for signs, unwilling to forget they had been property to the likes of him a dozen years before. Emily didn't remember the twisted life they hinted at, the slavery times, and each of the women hid the memory of those days as if there were shame in them, seldom talking particulars, at least when she was within earshot. They talked obliquely, as if it were an affliction she had escaped, a void of understanding that made her fortunate. Emily and Joseph had no part of those long-ago days. Her only memory was of dancing for her father in the woods before he went off to war, with her mother looking on. Joseph had still been in France, undergoing his own struggle, trying to overcome the bitterness of being cheated of his inheritance by his older brothers, working his way toward the idea of opportunity in America. Neither of them was so tied to a past that they couldn't see a future stretched out before them, like a twisting stream they could ford together. Joseph was full of infectious ideas of land and money, and when he was in a good mood, he talked to Emily for hours about his plans. He burned as hot with proving to his brothers back in France that he could acquire a fortune, as he did for the company of Emily and their child. It had taken 6 months after the baby was born for her wardens to finally invite Joseph to Sunday dinner, the time reserved for family. The table was full, piled high with food, every chair in the house pulled to the dining room to accommodate the guests. They were all here. Elizabeth, Suzette, Doralise and Yellow John, Joron and Melantine, Bette and Isaac, and the small ones at the children's table. And Philomène, heavy with her 10th child, who would be uncle or aunt to Emily's little Angélite, although Angélite would be a year older. Broad and full around the middle, Philomène carried this baby low, and was so big that she had to slowly ease herself into the chair at the dining-room table. Emily thought about how different she was from each of them sitting around Sunday's table, marveling that she could have come from them all. The old ones had not shaken the submissive ways of their years as slaves. Even her mother was scarred, incapable of looking for the joy Emily intended to claim as her due. Her half-sister Bette was more like them, tame and too easily content. Suddenly, a blue-banded bowl went crashing to the floor, spilling the creamed corn. Philomène stared around the table, looking in wonderment from face to face, as if the gummy yellow mixture had not splattered on her shoe, or the sharp splintering of the bowl had not set Angélique to crying. Philomène settled her hands high across her stomach, fingers laced one over the other, and began to laugh. "We got them this far," Philomène said, exchanging a satisfied look with Elizabeth and Suzette. "We can ease up just a little. My two girls can handle it now." Side by side, light and dark, Emily joined Bette in cleaning up the mess.
Chapter 32. Narcisse removed Emily's portrait from the wall opposite his bedroom door. The room was to be repainted a cool cream color before Liza moved in on Saturday. He studied the picture, as he had done so many times before. Emily stared back at him, chin tilted just so, the jaunty hat atop her head. He would give up the painting tomorrow, but it was still his to enjoy today. Her grace and dignity disarmed him, as always, reached out to him, making him both sad and proud. He had protected her as best he could. Narcisse had been without a wife for 12 years, drifting too long without a legitimate heir. Circumstances were no longer as rosy as they had been in the full bloom of his youth, back when he still counted upon the earth to deliver its bounty to him, and fortune always smiled. The time had come to get his tangled affairs in order, to make right what had somehow gone so wrong. Within a few days he would marry again for the third time, and there were still the legal matters to finish off first. So much time wasted, and misspent energy. How long ago could he have produced an heir if he hadn't been fooled? It had turned out to be the women's fault after all, not destiny, not some curse. Once the white children started coming, his manhood reasserted itself vigorously, building to a potency that produced 5 children in the last 4 years, and another on the way. Whether they came from the former slave woman who had managed to twist his thinking for so many years, the hill woman who had broken the former's hold,